Every single year, millions of new retail customers land here in Dubai and head over to places like the Dubai Mall, which is just a couple of minutes away from here, as well as the thousands of restaurants and beach clubs in this city. The question we're going to try and get an answer to today is, how do the brands in these malls and hotels end up here? And so to answer that question, I've got James Poole joining us on Algo today. Thanks for joining us today, James.
Thank you, guys.
It's our background is a little bit kind of cool because you're from the My Friends, Your Friends community. You attend our events, and me and you had one of the most interesting conversations about On Shoes. You knew about that brand way before anybody else. And so I wanted to get you on the podcast and grill you about this because a lot of our community want to know about it. And joining me to grill you, as always, is Vic.
Hey, how you doing?
Morning,
thanks,
man,
for joining us, James. And I'm excited about this one. We've been speaking for some time about this topic.
A while.
So much so that I've actually got some questions printed out to grill you on. So where better to get started than your background?
Yeah, let's start with that. So you help facilitate a lot of top brands, very recognizable brands coming into Dubai, and Dubai is exploding. Where do you even pick that skill set up from? What's your, what's on the LinkedIn?
What's on the LinkedIn? So it's 20 years in the Middle East. So I left university half my life ago, which is a crazy thing to say, and headed out to Kuwait. And since then I've worked for a variety of sort of global consultants. I've done in-house with HSBC. I did in-house with Imar, who built the Dubai Mall downtown. That's pretty much all their legacy. I did a little bit with Alpha Tame, who are, again, one of the leading retailers and landlords. I've done tenant-side, client-side work. And then the back end of 2022, I set up by myself. And now we have Seven Fronds, which is retail consulting. And our sort of focus is to, as you say, help brands expand. Whether that can be to enter the market, to enter Dubai, enter the GCC, or they're already here. They want to expand, they want to get new footprints. We try to help match make brands with operators. So hot brands who want to enter the market, we'll try and match make them to get in, or we'll give them advice to enter direct.
Right. So you mentioned in-house. What's the food chain look like? When you said you're in-house, does that mean that you're like salaried by Imar to decide who goes into Dubai Mall?
Exactly that. So I was part of a pretty big leasing team. As you can imagine, Imar has a pretty hefty leasing team in there. You've got nearly a couple of thousand stores in Dubai Mall to lease out. So we worked in a team, and it would be strategic in terms of we're building a new mall. We'd build Dubai Hills is the newest one. And we would like a lay of the land. Where do we put Nike? Where do we put Puma? Where do we put Zara? So we would give them all like where they need to go, the percentage of the F&B mix, the percentage of the entertainment mix. And then we would actively approach brands from around the world. They could be existing brands. They could be up and coming brands. They could be spin-off and collab brands. And we would literally pick up the phone to them and reach out to them and say, it's Dubai Mall calling. Would you want to come here? Are you interested? And that's a pretty powerful statement when someone picks up the phone and it's a brand in London or Australia and it's saying, yeah, we're the Dubai Mall. Do you want to come and talk to us about a shop? And Dubai Mall is, it's seen as the world showroom is how I like to say it. You know, if you're a brand and you want to be a known brand, you should be in that mall. You should be there and have a presence. And that's also how brands almost perceive it to be. Some of them will even if it doesn't do particularly well business-wise, like sales-wise, they'll write it off as a marketing expense to be in that mall because it's to be seen and be seen in that mall next to the powerhouses. It's brand kudos.
What's the rationale though? Like someone says, okay, James, we've got this mall, we've got this many outlets available, this much square footage, this mix. How do you even begin to put that sequence together?
It's a good question. Like, you know, we'll start from, I say that it's not the easy part, but the bit, your big boxes, your anchor tenants. We want the Zaras, we want the H&Ms. You'll need a hypermarket. You'll want a big Nike in there. Then you'll have the entertainment, the cinema boxes. You'll fill those big boxes first, and then you'll filter into the big brand category mix, like your high street fashion, your fast fashion. Where is the mall going to have premium brands? Is it going to have high street brands? Is it going to have low, like the value brands, I'd like to call them? And then we start sort of seeding that mix. And the way it works heavily in this region is a lot of operators, like there's an Asda Deer and Al Shire, the Alpha Tames of this world, the Altayers, they will have a portfolio of brands that they manage. So they could have anything from 10, 15, up to 30, 40 brands within their portfolio. So we will then go out as the landlord and sit down and have a conversation with them and say, look, here is the mall. What brands do you want to bring? What brands do we want from your portfolio in here? And that's how those discussions start taking place. It's like a jigsaw puzzle. So, you know, you'd start with the edge of a jigsaw puzzle and then you start filling it in. And so when you get on a bit of a run and you start sort of getting clusters. It's like what we call it. You know, you'll have a feminine area, you'll have the jewelry area, you'll have a sports and lifestyle section of a mall. And we'll build that together, kind of almost brick by brick, until we have a nice flow, a nice mix within that mall. Then when we've got, say, a big part of the deals done or percentage of the deals done, then we'd start talking more to maybe sort of the independents. And when I say independents, it could be groups who've only got two or three brands, or it could be brands direct who just, they just do jewelry, or they just do perfume or something like this. And then we'll start slotting them into this mix as well, to build out how that more tenancy mix is going to go and look.
What as a portion, how much of your inventory gets swallowed up by these massive groups that have got 30, 40 brands?
Because
surely like that's a big batch wholesale deal for
you, right? It's great for a landlord in terms of we get that commitment of space taken away quite quick, which is great for them. That's essentially what the main task is, to lease that mall. So if we can get almost 40%, 50% of it sort of locked up with the big groups quite, I wouldn't say quickly, it still takes a lot of time when you've got to do a 15, 20 brand negotiation. And that will be in the tens of the millions of dollars in terms of rental commitment for the operator. And it's going to be in the tens of millions probably as well for the fit out. So that's not going to be a quick decision. But as I said, once we've sort of got that in place, then we can start moving down and start doing other deals. As for retailer, you know, it's a little bit of a land grab, if you, I can say it one way. You know, they want to cherry pick the best locations for their brands. And unfortunately, there is a bit of arm wrestling that goes on. Like, we might want Sephora because we know Sephora drives traffic. They love it out here. It's an amazing brand for the Middle East. It's a powerhouse brand. They could almost dictate to us as a landlord where they want to go. But then we say, okay, great, if we give you this, but then we also want you to bring these other two, three, four brands. And they might be a little bit reluctant to give us, I don't know, a Charlotte Tilbury or, I don't know, a Next. It could be a Paul Cafe. Or one of the big bone of contentions is something like a Starbucks. So everybody knows and loves Starbucks. Well, I don't love it. I don't like the coffee. But here it's a cash cow of a brand. You know, it's big margins. It performs very well. But they would even say to us, right, we want four Starbucks in your new mall. And as a landlord, it's not good because we want diversification. We want different brands. You know, we want homegrown coffee. We like Arabica is a great brand out here. We want to put that in. But then they go, well, if you don't give us four Starbucks, we're not going to give you Sephora. And it's this wrangling will go on. But we'll normally get there in the end. So maybe someone has to take a little bit of a knee. But typically we get there,
So then if you fast forward now to where you are as Seven Fronds.
I'd
imagine, obviously, there's a lot of similar characteristics in the way that you work, but a lot of fundamental differences, because you're not ringing on behalf of Dubai Mall.
No, exactly. Like, it's now we're almost the other side of the table a bit more. We're representing the clients more. And the brands directly. So we don't have, on the one side, we don't have the weight of a landlord behind us. And then maybe we also don't have the weight of one of the retail groups behind us. Because best will in the world, the Alshires and the Azadirs, they don't need us. They've got their own teams. They're super strong. It's maybe sort of, again, like the tier two operators who do need a bit more help, do need to get their brand put in front of the right eyes.
So now you sit in between these two parties.
We now tend to sit in between, but I would say 90% of our work is with brands and the operators.
We don't do much
with the landlords now. We know what it is like to sit on their side of the table, but now we mostly look after brands. And that's what we want to do. You know, we want to help the brands get out there. It's a little bit more interesting to me, especially the up-and-coming brands, and see how we can push them into the malls and get their brand in front of the right people.
So now if you're sitting between these two parties, how do you typically synchronize them? So, you know, they're going to have their own challenges, their own goals, their own, like, targets that they want to hit. What's the qualification process between the two brands, and how do you kind of synchronize them?
Well, it's a big part of it is managing expectations. Especially for the brands who think they've got a rock star brand. And that's great. Everybody's got a rock star brand. And I say to people, it's like, it's almost time to tell people their kid's not as pretty as they think. Unfortunately, you know, there's a queue of brands. I speak to sort of the head of leasing in some of these malls, and they'll get 50 brands a day, 50 presentations of 50 different brands they could get in a day. So we're trying to make sure that when they do get that time to get the eyes on their brand, what they're showing them is the best opportunity. You know, it's the best impression of their brand is what they want to see, because we know what the landlords like to see. And we see it quite a common problem is the brand could be quite strong, but the way it's presented in these presentations, and you're going to get someone flicking through this on a phone for 30 seconds is how most people review stuff now. A profile will be flicked on a WhatsApp to somebody. They'll have a quick scroll through. And if it's pages of content, people aren't going to read that. They want to see the sexy designs, the sexy storefronts, what's their social media, what collaborations, what celebrities are wearing the brand. This is what they want to see. They don't care that you started it 10 years ago from the basement of your. They don't care. It's a nice story, but they don't care.
Give us a little bit of detail on that. So if you've got a brand that you want to present to an operator, how do you prep them for this kind of presentation?
So we prep them, we give them examples. Best in class examples is how we like to do it. We say we have quite a decent client book, so we would show them saying, look, this is a great example, here's a poor example, maybe this is where you sit in the middle, and we'll steer them to give them refine it, rework it, push maybe the social media angle on them, push their influencer angle on them. And then, as you said, to go back to the landlord side, if they maybe haven't heard of this brand, or maybe the brand had a bit of a legacy issue, like it was in fashion 10 years ago and then it kind of disappeared and it's come back, that's our job to try and almost convince them to look at it, because there's other brands that are probably going to be maybe a bit more of a sure bet. So we've got to try and convince them to take a look at this, and also give them in background on the operator. Have they got the investment behind them? Have they got the ability to operate the brand? What other brands have they done in the past? And what we've seen, unfortunately, in the last sort of 6 to 12 months, are brands that have entered this market from other regions. Maybe they were strong in those countries, but they were new to this market. And for one or two reasons, the funding dried up, the operators weren't skilled, they didn't know what they were doing. And they failed pretty fast. So now we are getting sort of questioned a little bit firmer than we were maybe 6 to 12 months ago about the background and who are these people.
Show the books kind of thing.
Show the books a little bit. Show us their collateral, show us their credentials, show us some proof that they've done what they say they can do. If someone's got one store in Monaco, great. Doesn't really mean you're going to be a slam dunk in Mall of Emirates here. Fortunately, it doesn't.
Yeah, I love nothing more than seeing somebody come into the market, whether it's a new DJ or a new business, and come in with a crap ton of ego and then just slam into a wall and have a massive violent car crash.
Oh, it's brutal.
But in a good way, right? Because then that's a big learning curve for people.
No, I don't care about it. I don't even care about it for them if it's a learning curve. I just love, we've all seen it. We've all seen people come in with their shoulders back and their chest forward and they're like, oh, we do this in London. We do this.
We're going to kill it.
Yeah. Give us some car crash stories. Yeah. You don't have to give away any particular brands.
Yeah, okay.
But just give us the blueprint.
It's a good example.
And if you can, do me a favor, answer that in the context of what are the common misconceptions when it comes to UAE.
Yes. We won't name names because it's other people's business and they're not good stories, but the F&B realm, it's a very hard realm. It's difficult to wow people here. We're so used to being wowed on a regular basis. The bars, the clubs, the beach clubs. Everybody wants to be an Instagram hit. Everybody wants that picture, that hero shot to show their friends. So when F&B, when they launched, people can overpay and overspend. And I say they overpay by they pay too much rent to try and secure a location that they think is just because I've got this sexy location, I can open and do almost anything. People will come just because of that. Then when I say they overspend, I'm relating to when they do the fit outs and the designs. It's very easy to get carried away. It's a little bit like when, say, somebody starts doing their house, and they're like, do I need the gold taps? Do I need the silk curtains? Do I need the lamp? Do you need all this? When you really just want to make it work well and functional. And I've seen it in a case where they opened a Peruvian Japanese restaurant. There's a ton of these in the city. It's not a new cuisine anymore. It was hot. You're sport for choice in that area, I think. But they opened this location, good location, stunning backdrop, Burj Khalifa backdrop. Wow, you sit there and you're wowed. They spent $2 to $2.5 million on their fit out. There's no need to spend this amount of money. They got everything was like custom glassware, custom cutlery, custom this, custom that. And the guy was like, soon after opening, they were like, we're bleeding money on this. And he was like, what can I do about it? And they wanted some help to even try and sell the restaurant. And because he spent so much money on it, he wanted to try and recoup as much as he could. And we were speaking to them about the same, but where have you overspent so much? And he was like, they're saying, oh, but the wallpaper, I spent $200,000 on this leather wallpaper. And I'm there going, but my friend, the wallpaper's behind you. The hero shot is in front of you. Everybody's going to sit at this table in all this restaurant and look out at the Burj Khalifa at this beautiful view. Nobody cares about the black leather wallpaper that you've got going on. That's worthless. You could have gone to IKEA and bought that. So it's just, unfortunately, it's maybe designers coercing them to spend more money, or they just sort of like, emotion overtakes the business side of things. And then you can see they hugely overspend, and then they've got to scramble to get that money back. And typically an F&B or a decent retailer, they'd be looking at 15 to 18 month payback of when they open. That would be a pretty successful story for them. You know, you do a feasibility, you study, it'll take you, if you're doing all right, 2-3 months to ramp up and get business, get, you know, the word of mouth, the marketing starts working, you get bums on seats. But if you're still scratching around after 6 months and you're still not really getting there and you're still going to buy all that fresh produce and all that beautiful wine and all those high-class staff that you hired, you're bleeding money and you're bleeding money quick.
Yeah.
And that's when people come, unfortunately, will come to us and say, I want to cut and run. Mm. But then we have to then manage the expectation of, okay, you spent all this money and now you want someone to come and pay it off you. Okay, everybody knows if you go and buy a Ferrari and drive it off the showroom, it's not worth what you paid a minute ago, buddy. 30% of that is gone straight away.
Yeah.
And this is how we try and manage expectations to try and get people out of these difficult situations when they do fail.
I've had this with my friends, your friends as well. It's so funny. Obviously, I spend a lot of time talking to like F&B managers, GMs and stuff like that when I go in and I explain my friends, your friends. So firstly, I've got like the video that was made for us by F10, which does a lot of the heavy lifting for us. It explains the concept. But sometimes I get pushback where obviously we need stuff for our community, right? Drinks, free entry, maybe some snacks and things of that nature. And people are like, well, you know, we can only do happy hours, but the happy hour drinks are going to be 55 dirhams. And I'm like, wait a second.
It's not very happy.
Yeah. And I'm like, hold on a second. I'm asking you to do happy hour drinks that you're normally doing during the week for 35 dirhams. You're increasing them for me for some reason. And these are part of the negotiations I have to do with them. And I say, Hank, just keep it like this. You're going to give away 300 to 400 drinks at cost, which is, let's say, 25% of retail. For 25% of retail, let's say the drink is 40 dirhams, 10 dirhams a drink, 400 people, 4,000 dirhams. So for anybody listening overseas, about $1,000. For $1,000, we will activate your venue and put 400 people in there. Or you can do what you normally do, which is go and pay a PR company a crap ton of money.
Yes.
Who will bring down a bunch of influence for a night, who will never come back because those it influencers
might not even
only
be relevant influencers.
They come to, this is the thing. I see these launches and these galas and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, any venue can look good. If you give away champagne, oysters, and you shoot it all in 4K and then put it in slow-mo and put it out, of course that looks like the new cool place to be. But none of those people come back because they were only driven there because it's the opening night and the food and drinks were free. When we bring the My Friends, Your Friends community there, I've been back to every venue that we've ever done a My Friends, Your Friends in.
Sucre was great.
Yeah.
Man, that was a great venue. That was
and
good.
I go to those venues and there's been at least 3 times where I've walked into those venues and someone's come up to me and be like, yo, Raj. I'm like, hey, what's up, man? Nice to meet you. What are you doing here? They go, yeah, I've started coming here since My Friends, Your Friends. So I think people don't have that like holistic point of view as to how to do a successful activation. Normally, they'd rather just go and burn 50,000 dirhams with a PR company. They do an activation and then the following weekend after their activation, all of the fancy girls and guys that work in that PR company are in somebody else's beach club on Instagram.
Getting paid to be there.
They're not really riding for the client. So here's my
thing. Of course they're not. They're hired help.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the end of the day, they're hired help to be there, like a few pretty pictures and to blast it out. But are they the right people that you want to see there? You know, if it's you're a banging restaurant, do you care if it's like some it girl influence that's been seen there?
Well, what I was saying is it's the PR company. So the PR company, which obviously has a lot of like, you know, beautiful people working inside them here in Dubai. And you're like, okay, you did my activation last weekend and the fees I've paid you, you and your company are now in somebody else's beach club the following week. You know, like when you could be advocating for us, like we advocate for our venues that we work with and clients that we work with. So that leads me all back to the same question, which is with that kind of like complex territory, that very kind of difficult surface area. In 2024, is it still worth coming to Dubai in the UAE to grow your beach club or restaurant or retail brand?
Great question, Raj. Great question. I'd say yes. I still say yes. The opportunity is there if you get it right. It is a congested party now. There's a lot of, it must be in the tens of thousands of the bars and restaurants in Dubai now. The retail, people seem to be fixated on Dubai Mall and Mall of Emirates. No, they see it as a slam dunk. But I think brands, if they want to be taken seriously and on a global scale, let's say, they should be represented here. And I think now, which is quite surprising, we speak to people in the hospitality industry who obviously frequent other cities. They go to the Paris, the Genevas, the Londons, the New Yorks of this world. And even they come to Dubai and they see even Dubai now is setting the benchmark for hospitality, which is an incredible thing to say. You know, if people used to ask you in the past, where would you go? Where in the world is the best food? People will probably, you go to Paris, you go to London, you go to New York. This is, you know, Tokyo. You go there. This is where the best restaurants are. Dubai is now massively in that equation. It's usually in that conversation. It's usually in that conversation now. I went to one in London and we're bringing this concept here. Amazing operator, super switched on guy, great concept. They've got several locations all across the UK. The open one in London, they spent a lot of money on it, you know, hell of a lot of money. And I went to look at it. You know, we hopefully bring them here. They will open here. And I walked in, I had a look around. I ate and it was great. But you know, I walked in, I'm used to Dubai. I'm used to the standard of what we have. So I walked in and I was like, this is good, nice, but I was like, but if I pick this up and I put this in Dubai, you're just in the pack. You're in with the pack again. You're not going to be wowing. So I've had to kind of say to him, as nice as you kind of could, but as a professional, we're saying, your concept's great, your delivery of it is great. I said, but you're still going to have to up it.
Yeah, I noticed. I spent a lot of time going back to Dubai and back and forth, like from 2014 to 2017. I was like living 50-50, London, okay. Dubai. And that might be my future now moving forward. And I was in London last week. And when I used to have that back and forth period, I was on a podcast once and someone said to me, like, you know, what's it like working in both cities? And I said, well, it's great because it's an arbitrage. You fly to London, you basically fly to the future, you see what's happening, and then you bring it to Dubai in terms of the stuff we were doing in content. But post-COVID, flying to London's like flying to the past.
It is.
You know, it's weird. Like, it's like the tables have turned and London's where you normally go to get the benchmark and the standard. Now, when you go there, you're like, this is terrible.
This is terrible.
Dubai is like the new gold standard.
And it surprises people. Like, it's efficient. It's so clean. The level of service is impeccable here.
Yeah.
But that is just because the market standard and the benchmark is so much higher now. And don't get me wrong, look, you go to the Annabelle's and the sexy fish of the world in London, they are top level. But that we're saying the general across Dubai service, it's amazing.
But what is it? Was it COVID or what did that?
I don't know if it was COVID. I think Dubai markets itself very well and obviously opened its arms to the world. It made the ease of access to do business was greatly reduced. It welcomed the digital nomads, you know, the freelancers of the world. We were one of the lucky ones that, you know, we barely had a lockdown. You know, we had, 6-7 weeks, I think, at the time. It really wasn't much. And we were back almost normal life very quick.
Right.
And I think people here, they realize that, you know, the government acts quick. It's a very opportunist city. If you come here and you hustle and you work and you do the networking, you can really make a go of it here. And I think also it's very accessible. And I say this in terms of people are very accessible. If you need to get hold of the senior people in various, the landlords, the companies, the investment companies, you know, you can work your way. With My Friend Driven, this is a great example. Great example, your networking event. You go in there and you can come away going, wow, I've met some pretty heavy hitters in here. And I can say it to you, and I'm not trying to flatter you, but I went to a lot of networking events in the last 18 months, and the quality of who you had in that venue was a set above the other ones. You know, people there, they were there to talk, they were open. People giving you the time, they're giving you advice, they're giving you contacts. And that's what this city is about. Dubai is about that. It's helping other people. It's opening doors. It's that spider web of a network that I can tap it on this side. And on the other side, it can be felt pretty quick. Whereas I think you go somewhere like, I know London, I haven't really worked in there, but I'd say it'll be hard. You know, it's a super competitive. There'd be a hospitality people who come here. They say London is hard. They even say London is finished. And I was like, that's a huge statement to say. But they're like, it's too expensive. The cost of doing business is too much. We're going to come over here now and say, we're going to try. And I think that's why it makes a big difference.
Yeah, spending over 30 years working and living in London, it is a graft. You know, you've really got to grind the gears. So, and I think you're right. You know, the minimum standards across Dubai and the UAE are higher than most places in the world.
In the world.
Which is why we have these minimum standards that everyone's got to meet. So thinking about what we were talking about just now, like in terms of bringing brands over, you've been responsible for some.
Yes, some.
Let's look at a success story.
Mm.
So in some of our calls previously, you've mentioned a few, but one that I really wanted to kind of drill down on and understand a bit more was Gitano.
Gitano, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about how that came about and just some background on that and just
sure
up for us. Yeah.
Obviously, for the audience reference, so Gitano or Gitano means gypsy in Spanish. So it's a beach club that was started in Tulum by a gentleman called James Gardner. He used to actually work on Wall Street, and then he turned his hand to day club beach clubs. He opened in Miami, and they also did a pop-up in, I believe it was Soho in New York, and now they have a full 7-month day club in Governor's Island. So I got introduced to them. It's almost one of these funny stories about how it happened. It was actually one of my neighbors. She said, oh, I've been in touch with this brand. It's a super cool brand. They want to come to Dubai. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, wouldn't say kind of roll my eyes, but I was like, oh, here we go. What's this? Got on the call, this exuberant, flamboyant, quite driven guys on the other end of the call. I have a look at the beach club online, and it's cool. You know, it is very out there. It's very well curated. It's very hip. It will do well here. I was looking at it saying, I can see why that would work. It's contemporary Mexican. There aren't very many contemporary Mexican concepts here, especially at a premium level. So anyway, I kind of looked at it. I said, yeah, let's see, you know, what do you want? And they're like, well, we want a location, we want an operator, and we want an investor. And I was like, well, do you want anything else?
Do you want a
pink
chef?
Ferrari? Do you want a pink Ferrari?
Said, okay, do you want extra for the guac?
Yeah, exactly. I was like, extra the guac. I was like, well, okay. And you know, I was like, I left there going, well, great concept, great guy. I was like, but that's a pretty hefty wish list. So then I have a couple of clients, and I was speaking to one of them and saying, oh, we're trying to get one of the new beach spots down in La Mer, which is, for people that know, used to be kind of like a non-drinking kind of like family area. There was a water park, I think. Mm. Completely demolished. It's going to have some of the biggest nightclub beach clubs in the world. I think there's a 90,000 square foot beach club going to go in there. I think it's the biggest in the world that's going to go in. Heavy hitters in there as well. Great names. And they found out that there was a small opportunity to go in and not poach, but take a unit because someone wasn't coming up with the final contract. So we found the location through my network. We found this location was actually available. My client, they didn't have a concept to go in it. They put forward one or two concepts that they did have, and the landlord was like, well, we don't want Italian. Well, we're not interested in the French. And I said to him, look, Vijay, I said, I've got this concept out of Tulum, New York. And I was like, it's pretty cool. Have a look at it. So I sent it to him, and they literally came back saying, yeah, the CEO wants to meet them. Let's speak to them. So we want to try and get this done. And I was like, okay, so we literally got on a call, and he's based in New York, we're based here, and then we'll have the call, and they'll explain to them what they want to do, and they showed them the opportunity. And the guy, James, he was a little bit surprised. He was like, well, I didn't expect it to come around this quick. And I was like, well, neither did I. But you know, sometimes the stars align in your favor. You know, you may have to jump on this pretty quick. So the long story short, they flew on the plane, they came over. The landlord loved the concept. It fitted in well with the mix because it was like the only sort of this contemporary Mexican that's going to go in there, a very vibey, very holistic, bohemian is a good word calling it, a very bohemian kind of cool jungle vibe. They call it like Gitano Jungle Lounge, I think is what they're going to call it in the end. So you guys can check it out afterwards. It's great. So it took some time to get the two sides to meet, operator, the commercial elements, how it was going to work, what design commercial input they would have. Obviously the operational side would all come from here, and obviously the investment as well, and who would obviously just split the fees at the end of it as well. But we got that done in the end. It took time, and now designs are finished. I believe it should be taking handover fit out very soon, and then we look forward to the whole of J1 La Mer, which is what it's called, that whole new project. That should be open September this year.
Wow.
So it's another, it'll be a big scene for Dubai again. So it's bringing that West Beach beach club vibe to that part of the city.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of skepticism in the market. There is, saying, who's going to go? You know, La Mer wasn't the greatest success story. So they kind of cleaned the slate and started again. And now they're obviously going to try and attract that premium crowd from that side of Dubai. The people who go to Zuma, they go to Galaxy, they go to Clap, they go to these cool, funky places, they go to Iris and Soho. This is where they party on the weekend. They now want to bring that crowd down here on the beach club. So I'm on the fence a little bit. The brands are super hard, super strong, but you've already got West Beach, you have Blue Waters, you have Verde, which is killing it. You've got Master Al Arab, which is going to open, a couple of whopper new beach clubs are going to go in there. Namos is there. I said, how is this going to enter the market? 14, 15 new venues.
it's going to be crazy because it's already trafficy down there.
It's already pretty trafficy. So let's see what they've done about the infrastructure, because again, that was what a lot of people had first thought was it was pretty bad when Le Maire was down there. And Le Maire didn't even function that well.
Didn't know.
I think no one was going to try and hide from the fact that didn't work. Otherwise, they wouldn't have leveled it and redone it. But then when you go and drive around that part of Dubai, you've got Jumeirah Pearl coming up. You've got more developments. There's more high density coming in there. So let's see. The city's still going to grow.
The only difference with the beach club, though, from my experience with them, is that they are also day-to-night venues, mm-hmm. which means that you will have patrons, post 9 p.m. patrons that have arrived at 2:30 in the afternoon. So that traffic could have kind of, it might not boost up in the evening.
Yep.
People would spend the whole day there. But listen, man, like when that launches, if you get a plus two.
Oh, you're there.
If you get, I'll do you a better deal. If you get a plus three, we'll bring our own contemporary Mexican, which is Diego.
There you go.
One of our producers.
Yeah. I do have one question on what that
no,
case
no,
said,
yeah,
if I
yeah,
can.
Go on.
So just something a little bit tactical that I wanted to ask you. So you get introduced to this brand, and he says to you, I want everything. I need all the help. Regardless of it being Gitano, any brand that comes to you, what's the first thing that you do? Like in terms of your process, how do you kind of come off that call and go, all right, these are the first one, two, three things I need to do. How do you approach it and what's your thinking behind it?
You have to be a little bit critical. You know, not just mental, but a little bit critical, because, you know, you've got to sit there and speak to somebody about the brand, and it's a new brand. It may be a completely new brand. We've not heard of it before. And we've got to understand, like, where's that brand's expectation, their ambition? What market are they in at the moment? And will it translate to this market? Everybody likes to tell you they've got the next LV, they've got the next Prada, or they've got the next Supreme, the next Off-White. And that's quite hard to quantify on just a call. So we'll obviously listen to them, listen to their history of the store, of their story, of the brand, of how it came to be. We'll check out their socials, we'll check out their, you know, and it's some of the most simple thing that I can go and look at is, I had really recently, again, it was a restaurant from Costa Rica and Mexico. They've got 15 locations and they want to come to Dubai. So I was like, well, I was going to, okay, that sounds reasonable. So I had a quick look on their socials. They had 3,500 followers. I was like, you've got 3,500 followers in Mexico and Costa Rica, and you now want to bring that concept to Dubai and hope that's successful. I had to be quite critical to them. And I was like, I don't see how this, you're not that strong. How is that going to suddenly translate to working in this market? Have you done any homework? Have you got an operator? And a lot of these questions are like, oh, no, don't know. So then it just starts, alarm bells ringing a little bit. It really does. But then to flip it, say, on the nicer side, I can give you another example, probably a much stronger example of, there's a brand called Bimba Ilola.
Say that again?
Bimba Ilola. Spanish, it's a streetwear brand. Very Gen X heavy. It's a great brand. I didn't know too much about them. I mean, I meant to know. I didn't, but I got introduced to the global business development director for them. So I went to meet the guy, and I'm asking him questions, and he gives me one thing that straight away, I was like, okay, this is a brand. And it's part of the Caroline Herrera family. Everybody knows the Caroline Herrera family. It's their streetwear brand. There's 350 locations around the world. Wow. They operate 75% of those locations themselves. That's heavy. In terms of that's heavy. They want to come to this market. And as soon as I saw the story, I saw the quality of the product, and I was like, this is a slam dunk of a brand. You know, this isn't a hard sell to be. It's not a hard sell to landlords, because they will know, and it's not a hard sell to operators. So that due diligence was quite straightforward. And then we then wanted to matchmake that brand with an operator that complemented them. You know, an operator who's got premium level brands and has access also to maybe like a wide database, especially a feminine database. And that is pretty much what we've done. I can't say at the moment who's got it and who's done, but I would say I'd be surprised by the end of the year if we haven't got that done and opened in Dubai. But again, to go back to the question of like, how do we sort of say, give the credentials of the brand? What gave them the confidence to come to Dubai was they opened in Regent Street and they opened next to Apple. And the director said, this is the business development director for Bimba. He said, once we opened that store in Regent Street, he said, we had Arabs coming to us. The Saudis, the Kuwaitis, Qataris, the Emiratis, they love to go to London. They love to shop in London. Once they see a brand like that front and center, this must be a good brand. even if the product is great or it's not great, but suddenly it's kind of a little bit in their head. It's like, well, it must be good. If it's good enough to be next to Apple on Regent Street, it's good enough for us. And he saw within weeks of it opening in London, his sales in the Saudi store went up. The sales in the Bahrain pop-up went up. Because so even though they didn't have fully fledged stores, we said, but they suddenly saw that Arab interest go up. So that's what said, right, we need to jump on and we need to get Dubai going now. So that was interesting to see how that works. Like, so that the dynamic of it working in London gave the brand the confidence to like, now let's press ahead and open in Dubai.
And you can piggyback off that as well. And we can piggyback from a branding point of view.
Huge. Yeah. Huge.
Speaking of jumping on, I promised this at the beginning of the podcast because it's the first conversation that you and I have had of my friends, your friends. Tell us the story of On, the sneaker brand, and how it ended up here and your involvement with that.
Yeah, so On is actually distributed by a company here called the Enduro Supply. They're a great operator. They're a big distributor of sports brands. Around 20 brands they have. Friends of mine work there, and I got asked to go and sort of assist in consulting for them to go to a physical store. But their founder, a gentleman called Omar Noor, who is an Egyptian triathlete, he actually used to train with the founders of On. So back in the day, before On was even conceived, he was training with these guys. And then when they actually said, right, this is probably going back 10 years ago now, it's like when On was actually saying, now with a performance running shoe, he's like, let me be the distributor for you. So now his company is now the regional distributor for On. What they wanted our help with, going saying, look, you're the distributor, but we want to go to be the physical store. Because they don't have physical stores. They still don't have very many around the world. The one in Regent Street only opened, I think, last June, July opened, next to Gymshark, Lululemon. It's got a great location. It's doing incredibly well. But then they wanted support to prove to On that they had the capability to open On stores. You know, they've been the distributor. It's a great story. You've done really well for us. And the On principles are that they're very protective of their brand. They're one of the brands I'd kind of like to relate to them like almost like De Beers. So they drip feed the supply to the market, which might sound crazy. You would think, well, you're a shoemaker, you know, you have a performance, just put them wherever you want, you know, put them in the stores. Their mindset is to like, okay, you're our distributor, but we're only going to let you have a certain amount of our collection, which is quite a strange thing to understand. You just think, well, just here's the catalog, pick whichever models you want. And they're like, no, we'll give you like an allocation. A little bit how Nike do it with the top edge Jordan Airs, like allocation. So they are quite protective of the brand. They don't discount anywhere in the world. You go and look online, you won't find on the sales. They don't do it. It goes against them because they know we're not that. We're too premium, which is, again, quite not strange, but it's quite strong mentality to have. So then we gave them, as in Enduro Supply, we said, look, let's give them a rollout plan. Say, look, where are you going to take the brand? And they've got the capability in terms of, you know, the logistics side of things, but they wanted our support. Like, what size store should you have in Dubai? What size store should you have in Riyadh? What size store should you have in Doha Festival City, for example? So we give them those store parameters. We give them advice on the fit out costs, the designs. We even set them up with a designer here through our network, and they gave them this beautiful store design. A big feature of On is they want a natural rock to be part of the installation. So they gave them all that as well. So ticking all these boxes for them. So we just gave them as much ammunition and armor to go to On principles and say, trust in us to give your brand the showcase it deserves to be in Dubai. So again, we're now hoping that that will go ahead and they'll secure a store. But as I say to a lot of clients, I said at the moment, there's a big queue for a good store in Dubai Mall. And as I kind of alluded to, On are quite like, okay, we're pretty good. You know, we only want the best. It will take some time for them to get that location that is befitting of the brand. But then, you know, you've got the likes of, again, Ema. They know the brand. If they want that brand, they will try and make that happen because they are, no, they're switched on enough to know that's a slam dunk of a brand when that comes in. So they're great people to work with. I say, you go and look at the quality of the product for On. It's literally market leading. The ethos started out to be a performance running shoe, but I don't know if they did it intentionally, but I think they've maybe got pulled in to being a lifestyle brand. I lived and worked in Saudi for a while ago in 2022, and the cloud shoes were everywhere. And no offense, but Mr. and Mrs. Saudi, they're not triathletes. They're not endurance runners. They're not out doing 20 kilometer runs every 3 days, which is what On was born for. They like them for the comfort and they liked them for the look. So because of that, they saw this huge influx of Arab buyers. And they did a pop-up in Yas Triathlon. And they had local women turning up and buying 10 or 14 pairs of On trainers. And these people are not doing triathlons in this. It's just a fashion statement for them. So they've seen that they've got they kind of moved more into like a lifestyle brand, like an Ally Yoga, like a Lululemon, like a premium level. And I think we're going to start seeing it even more from that brand's perspective, that they're going to lean heavily into this lifestyle category as well. So it's interesting to see how maybe those, they didn't expect that to happen when they came to this region. They were heavily focused on the running communities, the cycling communities, the triathlete communities, but it has been picked up by the Arab locals who like the brand. They want to push it and grow on that.
Yeah. That's inevitably the way it happened even for Nike and a few other brands, right?
They're lifestyle brands. Yeah. It's a lifestyle brand. You know, they're sports brand, but it's a lifestyle brand now, yeah.
So a couple of final questions just as we wind down. Number one, you spent a lot of time today when you're kind of like giving us the game as to how you do what you do, talking about like relationships, knowing this person, having a friend who had a friend.
And yes.
That's kind of the tapestry of society that is Dubai anyway.
Yes, 100%.
What are your top tips for networking, building and maintaining relationships, especially in your world where you are a broker?
Yeah.
And, you know, you could get circumvented. People could bypass you. I know there's in every business, there's nefarious and shady kind of components to it. So what, over your like couple of decades career, what are the kind of top tips you've built up in terms of building, maintaining relationships and then the art and science that is being a broker?
The art and science of it. It's relationships is a huge part of it. And doing what you say you're going to do. I think there's a lot of people in this town who promise and don't deliver. There's a lot of it. I came very recently, literally last Friday, I met with the company. They've got a restaurant here. They want to expand it. And they were really reluctant to meet me. I didn't know. They were really reluctant to meet me. But a friend of mine made the introduction. He sat me down. And they were like, they kind of grilled me, a bit like what you guys have done today. They were grilling me. And I was like, I'll sit here and bat your questions back. But you could see they were so averse to how they've been treated by people. People trying to get to pay them money up front for doing something. People promising them, I'll get you something here. And then you have to, then the fee would change or double at the end when they nearly got there. So when I got there and I downloaded the information I could, I gave them honest answers as best I could. And I said to them again, and I said, look, you don't pay me till we've given you what we said we'll give you. So anyway, we left the meeting. It was all very cordial and great. And I got a call afterwards from the guy I'd introduced it. And he was like, they love you. And I was like, really? And he was like, he said, because they didn't want to meet you. He said, they were just worried you're going to be another one of these guys, another broker who's going to come and promise you, and then they run away or take money. So it's that trust and integrity, building relationships with the people who you want to work with. When I first started working for myself, sort of like I said, back into 22, I'd say yes to a lot. Because I was a little bit worried, will it work? So I said yes. Now I start to pull back and say no. If I get a sense of what this client wants is unrealistic or they're going to tout around with every other person in the market, I said, I don't want to do that. I don't need to do that.
It's a branding signal in itself, isn't it? When you say no to stuff.
And now it's good. Like, you know, like if you needed something and you came to me and I said, oh yeah, then I'll speak to a friend of mine. I said, Raj needs this. Because it's coming from a trusted source, they'll readily help you. And I think Dubai is a small market, especially in what we do in the retail, the real estate, the leasing. It's a small market. People move between Nikhil to MAF, back to Weimar, then they go to another deal, then they move between the groups. It's a small cycle of a market. And if you start doing things that are untoward or you try and cut people and try and be clever, it's too small a market to do that. But as you said, go to the events, get involved in the communities, you know, just go and spend time in what you say you're going to be doing and go into the malls. Because I don't shop. It sounds stupid, I don't shop. But I like going into the malls to see who's open what, who's doing what. Get a bit of the market gossip, find out who's doing well, which brand isn't doing well. But then also give that information back out. You know, give the information to people. If someone says, oh, can you find me this out? Do it. If someone needs a contact, take it. If someone wants to know about a couple of locations, here they are, go take it. Give that information away. It builds that trust, that rapport. And just maintain being sort of the integrity side of things. You know, do what you say you're going to do, yeah.
Yeah, you're banking on reciprocation.
100%. 100%, yeah. That reciprocation is massive.
So now let's take a brand. Not a tier one, not an anchor brand, not a tier two. Tier three, tier four, up and coming. Before they even entertain coming into this market or a phone call with you. Actually, let's do that. A phone call with you.
Yeah.
What should they be doing? What's the preparation? What kind of questions should they be asking themselves? How should they prepare for a call with you? How do they qualify themselves? Just give me give me like the top 5 to 7 things that they should be doing before they even get on a call with you.
They should be, obviously they'll know their brand, but have their pricing ready, their competitors ready. Who do they see themselves going up against? The timelines, when are they ready to launch? Are they ready to set up in the operations? How do they want to run the operations? Is it a franchise? Is it a JV? Is it a direct to market by themselves? These are the kind of questions we'd expect them to have readily so we know that, okay, if we find you something, are you ready to hit the ground running? So we're just ready to sense checking them. And we want them to sort of know their concept and also but look around maybe the wider market and just see where the Dubai is growing. I just said, I think the communities in Dubai is a huge area of people to go to look at now. We keep saying to people, don't get blinkered by the big assets. You know, everybody wants to be in the Dubai Mall and Mall of Emirates, but we say, look, you've got to look a bit further away, especially for these brands, as you've mentioned. Are you open to partnerships? Are you open to doing pop-ups? Are you open to testing your brand here to see if it actually works, rather than going all in and putting everything on red 22? You know, it's test the water a little bit. Don't be scared to do that. That is what I recommend people do if they want to speak to us. But just ask us questions, you know, and where do you see your brand going? And what's your history as a person, as a company, as like, where's your skill set? I'll give you another great example is I got put in touch by these two girls in London. They want to open a salon. And I was like, okay, great. It's very nice. They've designed it. They're investment banker background. And they want to come and open salon out here in Saudi, in Riyadh. And I said, have you ever opened a salon? And they're like, no. I said, so you've never opened a salon and you now want to open a salon in Riyadh. Have you ever been to Riyadh? No. But we hear so much positive noise that it must be the place to be. And I was like, it could take you 6 months to just set up your business in Saudi. I said, you've never been there. And they were asking me to show them locations in Riyadh. And I said, I'm not going to go and run around a city like Riyadh for you when you've never opened a salon in London, let alone going to another country in the other part of the world, in the Middle East, that is still, it's still coming out. Is it ready for that kind of product that you're offering? So it startles me when people have these grand ambitions and then they've never even visited that market. It's like you and I saying, right, Raj, we're going to open a Mexican restaurant together. Okay, we're going to open it in Japan. We've never opened a restaurant before and we've never been to Japan.
Yeah.
But let's go to investors and prove to them we can do that. The ambition is amazing to see.
It's delusion and greed.
We'll
say it on your behalf.
We're playing this market all the time. And, you know, specifically like because I've built my brand as like one of the go-to guys in Dubai, especially for a lot of British people.
Yeah.
I put an Instagram post out the other day. It was like my top pick for 2024 is the UAE because some of the smartest people in the world are moving here. And I sit with a lot of them.
Yeah.
Off the back of that, I got 150 DMs of people that I would say 80% of them was just greed orientated, which is I have a business here. I want to open it in Dubai.
Yeah.
Or I have a job in the UK. It pays me X. I would like to get paid X plus 30% in Dubai.
Yeah.
Never been here. Never thought about like, are their skills transferable? I've had some people from the medical community reach out to me and be like, you know, I won't say what it was, but it would be one of the optom pharmacy, right? And they're like, I'm thinking about coming out there. Can I practice this medical profession? I'm like, haven't you Googled it? Like, what's wrong with you? Like, your greed has got ahead of you that you've actually messaged me.
Yeah.
And Seth Godin talks about this as well, which I think is really important. It's a lesson that people need to learn globally, which is that there's this stupid saying, which is like, oh, well, no harm in asking.
True.
There is harm in asking.
True.
If the first time you ask me something, it appears that you've not checked it on Google or you've not checked it on like AI Gemini by Google or, you know, you've not done any kind of research. There is harm in asking because you've harmed your brand by showing me that the level of due diligence that you should put in before you talk to me shows that it's not even deserving of your own time to due diligence that you'd rather just DM me and ask me, how do I do it? Which I think is a bit like disrespectful. Do you know what I mean?
It's a little bit, I have a dream.
Yeah.
And then they come to you to try and do it. And I was like, okay, look, I'll give you some advice. I'll give you some feedback. But when it's such a startling kind of between reality and what is achievable, it's like, really?
Yeah,
really?
You get that with a lot of investment bankers as well. They're quite delusional. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I think they grow up in jobs where they get, like, you know, bonuses and retreats to Turks and Caicos, and they think, oh, I'm immune to market forces, but they don't realize that rapper that is Morgan Stanley has protected them from a market slapping.
And almost maybe Dubai has marketed itself as, you know, it's you come here and everybody can be successful and make lots of money, and people have done that, but there's a lot of people who find it difficult. You know, the amount of people who've come here to be, you know, the residential brokers because they saw some guy selling a villa for $100 million, and next thing you know, he's driving around in a Ferrari. He's one of 50,000 probably who'd managed to do that.
Yeah.
You know, they don't show the other people who are just trying to shift rubbishy little apartments and studios tucked away in the back sticks of Never Neverland. You know, they don't show that, and people just think, oh, they can do it. I can want a piece of it. Well, great, but you've still got to come here and do the hard work and the hustle and focus on building a network and doing the simple things and doing the simple things right. And one thing I did want to mention is that, you know, Dubai's, there's two kind of markets, I think, here. There's the residents and there's the tourists. Which one are you going to go after? You know, especially as an F&B and a retailer, they're two very distinct things to go after. And if you're a homegrown concept or you're an up-and-coming brand, pick a battle to focus on. And I would say at the moment, if I was to say for the next year, I'd say to someone, I'd say, look more at the communities. You know, you live here, you live here. The amount that's been built, the new villas that are coming up, that are a little bit away from the city. You know, Dubai is maturing. It's becoming the kind of this now, this suburbs and this neighborhoods. You know, people don't want to visit Dubai Mall. People don't want to go to the Mall of the Emirates. It's painful to get in and out of there at times. Get the community stuff going well, and you can make much better money because your costs are less, you'll have loyalty, and you can have maybe a much more enjoyable business rather than the big stressful ones over here that you thought was going to punch your golden ticket.
And that's a really good place to wrap up as well, because that aside, you know, we know that there's going to be a parking fee coming to Dubai Mall and things of that nature, which is going to encourage people strategically or strategically discourage them from flooding that place. And of course, you've got other malls in other neighborhoods now. Expo City, you know, was on fire this week with the Untold Festival.
There's a lot of noise going on about Expo and what's going up there. But
yeah,
we've been approached by them to try and put clients in there. That's a hard sell.
Is it still?
It's a hard sell. It's still okay. It will be attractive to maybe people to operate and open concepts, but not till there's people living there in this critical mass. Mm. It's 25 minutes away from the city. You're not going to drive past three or four other destinations like F&B, other golf courses, other malls and neighborhoods like the marina and things like that. You're not going to drive past them to go to Expo
right
at the moment.
So like to summarize that specifically, pros and cons, like just to wrap up, what are the biggest trends and opportunities and avoidables for 2024, 2025 kind of time era?
I don't know about pros and cons. I think trends and opportunities I'd rather stick to. I said the communities. I think that's one. I think there should be a bit more concept stores here. When I say concept stores, not just a flagship boutique. You know, when you go to other countries, you go to the Madrids and you go to the Manchesters and the Liverpools and the Melbournes of this world. They have great curated concept stores. So you have multi-brands in that. I think that's something that really is underserved in this country, in Dubai especially. I think when people focus on the flashy name brand, I think the concept stores where there's a sort of more of a curation, they do a bit more community focused. I think that's got a real big opportunity to go for it next year.
Sounds like Amongst Few. So you're talking about the kind of place where you've got like
Amongst Few, yes.
Barbershop,
yes.
Highly curated boutique items, cool sneakers, their own brands,
yes.
Cafe.
But I think they need to be a little bit more, not quite so hidden away like Amongst Few is. Mm. You know, it doesn't need to be in the tier one malls, but let's bring them a bit more into the communities
yeah.
In the community, so it's there. And a big one, I think, is the kids and the F&B mix. And that might sound a strange thing, but we're starting to see it now. You'll have restaurant or cafe, and there needs to be more of an element to look after the children. So give them like the soft play, there's activities, there's something to keep them there. I speak to a lot of my friends, and obviously they will almost know if they've got kids. whatever they've done, like 834 above, let's go there. They want somewhere that they can go and sit, eat and drink and know the kids are entertained for 2 hours. And that will almost, you're nodding your head, really. It will almost be the deciding factor of, well, as long as the kids are entertained and happy, we'll go there. Even if the food isn't as good, even if the service isn't as good, but if my kids are entertained and quiet and out the way for a bit, from four to teenager age, that's a huge opportunity. And that's what we're seeing people coming in to do. And I think now you'll definitely see it. I tell people if they're opening a bar or opening a community pub, I tell them, I said, stick a decent sized kids area in there. Put some PlayStations in there. Put some soft play in there. Hire some people to look after them as well. And you'll be licensed to print money.
You'll be printing bigger receipts for sure, because you've got all of the kids. And again, I've seen it with Vic vicariously, like, if there is some sort of entertainment around, that could be the difference between staying for a coffee afterwards, after your dinner, or just wrapping up and bundling the kid up and getting out of there.
Or doing birthday parties. So I went to a birthday party. Yeah. There's a swimming pool in the McCafferty's in Alphajan. A whole bunch of kids, they just go and swim. The adults just hang out.
And they hang out and spend the money.
And it happens in Abu Dhabi a lot more. There's a lot more kid-focused ones as well. So,
and I think that, say, we can maybe end on, if Dubai market does slow, because it's been rampant, let's not hide away, it's been rampant for the last 12, 18 months. Like, it's come flying out of COVID. Other situations in the world have driven more money here. The tourist market has gone nuts. Dubai Mall had 100 million people, visitors, footfall. It's insane. There's insane numbers. If that market does slow, which it probably should just for the natural cycle of things, there's going to be some people who've over-leveraged, overspent, overcommitted. There's going to be some deals in there to be had. Distressed deals. The weaker brands will fall away. So like someone came and launched like a weak brand from Turkey, a weak brand from Russia or something like this that hasn't worked. There'll be opportunities for other retailers to come in and take that space.
Well, commercial real estate globally is under threat because a lot of people did their financing at a time where there was like zero interest rates. Mm. Is that the case here as well? Because you were mentioning leverage, and I'm like, is that going to happen where like leases are up and people are like, well, we can't raise the capital to maintain this?
It's just that the leases are going up and up. Like people are signing like 10% year on year increases in their rent. 10%, is your profit going to increase year on year? 10%? 30% increase in your rental cost in 3 years. Is your margins going to increase? But that's a lot to commit to. But people are just riding the wave at the moment and hoping it's going to keep going. If that slows down, unfortunately for people like us, we'll be there to say, well, when those restaurants fail and when the retail fails, we'll replace them with a stronger brand. Yeah,
love it, Vic. Are we good? I think
we are, man.
We should do more of these grilling sessions. We should call them like grill sessions. We should just bring like folks that we know in and be like, "All right, dude, you claim to know about this. Here's 30 questions, like Royal Rumble, pow, pow, pow. Ask them everything that we want to know."
Well, I'm interested. Like, it's really interesting to learn about this as well. And I think
we're both ex-retail kids. Both of our parents were shopkeepers.
Yeah.
So when you come in here and talk about retail, of course we're gonna be very selfish and just try and hammer you for everything we can.
We're good, man. I think we're good to wrap it up. Thanks a lot, James.
Thank you very much, guys. Enjoyed that.
Yeah, thanks so much. And we're looking forward to hanging out with you this Wednesday, 21st February, at the My Friends, Your Friends 20th special at Media One Hotel. Make sure you come and join us. I expect by the time you see this video that we've either completely run out of registrations or we're on like our final batch. But if not, head over to myfriendsyourfriends.com. We've got 20 of the best co-hosts, maybe from across the world, coming along to My Friends, Your Friends 20, 21st of February, Media One Hotel. Thanks so much for checking out this podcast. If you want to see Vic and I do more of these kind of grill sessions with people in our community, let me know who you'd like to speak to. You can DM us, DM me at Raj Kotecha or Vic Majaria. And those links are in the bio, and we'll speak to you in the next episode. Peace.